Do we have any questions?
My name is Father Ignatius, and I'm now in Longview, Texas. But once upon a time, I was a Protestant missionary in China. And something that piqued my curiosity, and I'm wondering what more you would say about it, is that you separated evangelism and incarnational ministry. Well, anyway, being culturally incarnational. I would have, you were talking about separating, what was it?
Philanthropy.
But I would tend to put together the incarnational and the evangelism. And I'm wondering if you had more to say about that, why you separated them more. Or if you thought of those together at all.
Sure, thank you. So, cultural incarnation is something that is manifest throughout all of the attributes. So our evangelism definitely must be culturally incarnate, but our worship should also be culturally incarnate. Our community life should be culturally incarnate. So everything we do, you know, that has to be something that plays back through all of it. And all of the attributes are manifest. All the attributes are interconnected, but in a way, cultural incarnation actually doesn't exist on its own because there's nothing, you know, it doesn't, there's no such thing as just pure cultural incarnation. But everything we do is in some sense culturally incarnate. The question is, if our culture is another culture is foreign. So you're absolutely right that our evangelism must be incarnational. And I'll talk about that this afternoon. That our missionary work must be intentionally incarnational.
Father Jeremy McKinney out of Roanoke, Virginia. More of a comment than a question, but I appreciated how you showed that Arianism and even the Judaizers of the first century were failed attempts forcing culture into the church and forcing the church to adapt the culture in an unnatural way. And I think that's an important thing because I've heard many discussions among clergy and laity about how do we make an American Orthodox culture. And I wonder if that's the wrong question. I wonder if it's something that just grows organically over centuries rather than something that we make. If you have any comments on that,
sure. So I think it's something we need to attend to. We need to be deeply immersed in the continuity of tradition over 2,000 years and, you know, understand that the church has, you know, been in a continuous process of incarnation. Often we think the only manifestation of orthodoxy that we've been exposed to is the only one there is. And that is orthodoxy and everything else is somehow not. But when we are attentive to the life of the church over 2,000 years, we see that there has been a continuous process of incarnation. And so being attentive to the incarnational process will help us to be incarnational where we are. But I think you're right that if we try to be incarnational in an artificial way, we can end up botching it and creating something that isn't so helpful. But if we don't realize, you know, I mean, the sort of, you know, from the evangelical days, but, you know, the King James was good enough for the Apostle Paul, that's good enough for me. You know, if we don't realize that that was a particular cultural incarnation at a particular time, that was done specifically so that the people of the time would understand it in their language, and if it isn't the language that the heart language of people today, it does not fulfill the principle for which it was created anymore. And we have some of this in our Orthodox tradition. So I would agree, but say that it's attention to the process over time. All right, maybe I'll start, and I'll give us more time at the end, and I'll give you some more things to ask questions about as we go along. So thank you again. Your grace and everyone who has chosen the ascetical high road to come out after lunch and resist the temptation of the beach and the pillow. So it's good to be together again. Thank you for your attention this morning. And we'll talk about a few more things and then hopefully have some time to ask questions and hear from you this afternoon. It's hard doing the questions and being interactive in this big group of pride this afternoon. So we want to dig a little bit more deeply into this idea. What is our apostolic identity? What does it mean that we are apostolic? Part of that piece of evangelistic. What does it mean to announce the good news to the world? So I stand sort of crooked and funny with this microphone, so bear with me. But so as I mentioned this morning, I was delighted to see that this is something that is already part of your articulated identity. There are many things that are part of our identities that we have no idea about. There are things that we have articulated that we also have no idea about. It's wonderful when we have an identity that's articulated and we know about it. On the OCA website, right there, front center, is the fact that the mission of the church is to make disciples of all nations. And that's very important that we realize that. And this, of course, is not just that we are missionary, but that we are making disciples. And everything that we talked about this morning is about disciple making. It is the difference between simply announcing the opportunity for a change in opinion, a change in mind, and inviting people into a community. And disciples are part of our people who have chosen to be part of a community and that have chosen a path of transformation over time. So this was something that Archbishop Anastasios in Albania was very instrumental in helping to bring back to us in the Orthodox Church. He grew up actually during the Second World War in Athens. Was a young person in Greece and deeply formed in the Orthodox tradition in Greece. But he began to notice some uncomfortable things. Like at the end of the Gospel of Matthew, there was a commandment that nobody seemed to have noticed. And back in 1959, he wrote an article for a journal called The Forgotten Commandment, speaking exactly about this text and saying, how is it that we as Orthodox Christians have forgotten the Lord's last commandment to us? The commandment that he gave saying, I have all authority has been given unto me, therefore. And this was really very much of Archbishop Anastasios' life work, was helping the Orthodox Church to regain its identity. So this icon here is in the apse of the new cathedral in Tirana. It's exactly the icon of the Great Commission. And if you come up, you can actually read it at the bottom there in Greek and in Albanian is the text from the Great Commission, the command to go and make disciples of all nations. Lest we be confused about what they understand. So this is very important to us to realize that being missional, that fulfilling this commandment is part of our core identity as Orthodox Christians. Archbishop Anastasios used to say that this is part of our DNA. And if we reject it, we reject our identity. We don't simply fail to obey a commandment, which we do. It is a commandment, a very imperative commandment, but we actually deny ourselves. And so the Archbishop got a lot of pushback for this in Greece in the 1950s and 60s and 70s.
They said, now you're bringing all of these Protestant ideas to the West. And he said, no, I'm not bringing Protestant ideas. I'm bringing us back to our real identity as Orthodox Christians. He said, you know, we can look back historically and explain how we're not where we are. We lived under Islamic rule for 400 or 500 years. During that time, it was almost impossible to do evangelism. And you know, people learned that that's something that we cannot do. And therefore, we do not do it because we can. And then there's this tiny little subtle step from we don't to we should. And as human beings, we have a hard time living with dissidents. We have a hard time with should but don't. We don't feel comfortable with that. So if we don't, then we're trying to say we should. And so coming into the 20th century in Greece, they said, we don't do that. We're not like other Christians. We don't go and evangelize. And the Archbishop said, no, we do, we must. It is not a suggestion. It is not if you can, but it is an imperative command. You must. And your identity as an Orthodox Christian is tied up in obedience. And so that is something that we really need to take to heart. I think as Orthodox Christians and Orthodox Christians in the United States, sometimes we have seen unhealthy models of evangelism. And we can say, we don't have to follow those models. But the answer to unhealthy models is not no evangelism. It is healthy models of evangelism. It is honoring, proper disciple making. And part of it is realizing that we are not called simply to ask somebody for a momentary decision about something or to pray a prayer, but we are calling them to become disciples throughout their lives, and not only disciples, but disciple makers. So, and we'll review just a little bit of what I said this morning, but now there's some pictures to help keep you away. How are we doing? So, Christ said, you know, go and make disciples of all nations. So, 2,000 years later, we are, as Christians, the largest religion in the world. There are more Christians than followers of any other religion. Yay for us, right? So approximately one-third of the world self-identifies as Christian. And an interesting thing about that number is, for the last 100 years, it has been almost exactly stable. There has been no change in the one-third. So we're not a larger percentage of Christians or a smaller. There are more Christians because there are more people in the world. There are demographic shifts in Christianity. 100 years ago, the majority of Christians were in Europe and North America. Now, the majority of Christians are in Africa and global South countries. So there's a lot of change within that stable line. There's a lot of stuff happening. We don't have time to go into all of it. But approximately one-third Christian, two-thirds non-Christian. But if we break those numbers down a little bit more, we see some interesting things. So first, at the top there is the little yellow sliver. That's the percentage of Orthodox Christians in the world. So around 4%, and this is actually counting everyone who self-identifies as Orthodox in both the Eastern and Oriental Orthodox families. So around 4%. And part of the bad news is that number has not been stable. 100 years ago, it was 8%. So we have lost in terms of percentage of the world. We lost 3% in the last 100 years. And that is because we have not been involved in the incredible missionary movement over the last 100 years that has spread Christianity around the world, out of the global north into the global south. We largely have been absent from that. So although there are more Orthodox Christians today than 100 years ago, we are a smaller percentage of the world total.
And so, you know, looking at that, we can have several different reactions. We can, like, despair, oh my gosh, 44% was us. Another way to think of it is, there's a story, this story is for the Diocese of the South, but one of the generals in the Civil War, one of the Southern generals that was leading an incursion to the North, and they came to him and said, "General, we are surrounded." And he said, "That's wonderful, we can attack in any direction." So, we can attack in any direction, not what we want to attack, but there is field for evangelism all around us. 96% of the world is not yet Orthodox Christian. So we have limitless field for sharing the wonderful treasure that we have received in Orthodoxy. But I also want to talk to you a bit about this, what we call unreached people. So on the graph we say 27%. You know, it's a very fuzzy thing, but it runs somewhere around really a third of the world. Probably slightly less, maybe actually slightly more. But I want to really talk a little more in detail about what this means. These are the people who have not made a choice. They cannot make a choice that we have made a choice on their behalf for them not to know. So, why is that? Why are there people in the world that have never had a chance to choose? Basically, there are three barriers, three fences that keep people from having a chance to know. And they are geography, language, and ethnocultural identity. And some of these are easy to understand, some of them are harder to understand, but they're all three are just as real. And any of these barriers will keep someone from being able to access God's words. So geography is the easiest, that's why it's first on the list. So if we look at a map of the world, this is very rough and on a country level. So there is much more granularity if you really look at it. But basically, the darker the color, the higher percentage of people that self-identify as Christian. In any tradition, any level of, they don't have to have ever been in church, they simply call themselves Christian. So you see some parts of the world that are quite dark. One of the interesting things, especially connected to what we just said, about the shift to the global south, the center of Africa is very high percentage of self-identifying Christians. That was not true 100 years ago. That is the direct result of intense missionary activity. But you see a band of territory across the map that is very widely colored. That means there are very few Christians in that place. That means there are very few Christian communities there. That means that if you live in one of those places, your chance of being adjacent to a Christian community where you can hear the gospel is remarkably small. You just aren't geographically placed. Now, there may be people that also have a very small chance of getting into dark colored places, and we'll talk about why that is as well. But with geography, it's easy to see if there's no witness there, that somebody has to go from somewhere where there is a witness to where there isn't, and plant a community so that there might be a witness. There is massive immigration towards the West in many cases that provide opportunities for us to witness to people coming to us. We should take advantage of that. That is a thing that in most of your parishes, you can actually do gospel witness into the light-colored areas right where you are because there is somebody from those places that lives next door to you. But we still need to be attentive to the fact that there are no witnessing communities there. And if we're there to be witnessing communities, we have to travel from here to there. We have to be the ones that take the initiative and cross the boundary to see that there becomes the possibility of a witness in those places. So the second thing is language. Hard to draw a picture out, so a few details of different languages.
Now, this seems like it's a little fuzzier, but it's just as real. I haven't seen one in this neighborhood yet, but often when I'm driving to speak at the church, I drive past a church with a big, beautiful sign in Korean. Now, if I were walking into that church, I am not going to understand what happens inside. They can say beautiful things about the gospel there, but it's in Korean. Geographically proximate, but linguistically varied. So we can have Christian witness in our geographical region, but if it's not in our language, it's a real challenge. And as we cross the geographical barriers that we were talking about, we very often also have language barriers to cross. So this means that our process of crossing to them involves both geography and language. Geography, we can be almost anywhere in the world in 24 hours. Language is much harder. So, language, for most of us, if you're one of those extraordinary, brilliant people who learns languages in months, don't come talk to me. Actually, do come talk to me because we can employees or use that, but don't come to me. But for most of us, acquiring a language takes at least 2 years of hard work, preferably immersed in a place that speaks that language. The bad news if you're over 40, it's way, way harder. This is one reason why when we talk more about deploying missionaries, we need young people. It is much, much easier. We know people too, but learning language is a young person's game for the most part. So, language is a major barrier. In order to cross it, it takes years. And then cultural ethnic identity is even more slippery, but even more real. People do not cross cultural ethnic boundaries most of the time, even when they live adjacent. They might go shopping, they might cross those boundaries for utilitarian things, but people tend to worship, tend to find their social and religious needs within their ethnic cultural group. It is very hard for people to cross ethnic cultural lines, especially in many places, there are historic, deep divides between ethnic cultural communities, where people really cannot go across that boundary to the other community. It's very hard. They don't want to, and they really couldn't. For family reasons, for all sorts of reasons. So again, we need a plan to cross in their direction. So geography is 24 hours, 36 hours. Language, 2 to 4 years. Ethnic, cultural transformation, decades to really become culturally incarnate in a new place. And so these are challenges that we have if we are to be obedient to Christ's command to go and make disciples of all nations. Now, your response probably is, well, that sounds really hard. And it is. It's not easy. But, as Archbishop Anastasio said, the Lord didn't say, well, if it's easy, if it's convenient, if it doesn't cost too much, go and make disciples of all nations. He said, go. And so this is the calling we have. And again, remembering, as we said this morning, that this is not an either or. We are to be witnesses here in our Jerusalem, in our Judea, in Samaria, and to the ends of the earth. But we're going to especially focus now on the ends of the earth because, unless we're intentional about it, The ends of the earth is very easy to forget. And it is very easy for us to invest all of our resources in us here. And the stewardship question. Now, God has given us such immense blessing in this country, such wealth, such ability to travel. Where do you think God sees the stewardship balance between us and our needs, and the people that he said, go and make disciples of all nations, that still have 2,000 years, we haven't even started? Think about it. So, and if you want to do some more reading, another book advertisement, I don't have any of these cells yet going on Amazon by yourself, but Archbishop Anastasios, as I mentioned, really one of the very seminal Orthodox thinkers in so many areas. Incredible missionary, incredible theologian, the head of our Orthodox Church, but he wrote this book, Mission Christ Way, which is actually a series of articles that he wrote over the years about thinking missiologically as Orthodox Christians. So, please go out, get it, read it. If you don't read it, read it again, because you probably missed a lot the first time I did. So, yeah.
This question may be premature, so forgive me. So we're getting into the mission of the OCMC specifically, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, we're getting into the mission of the church, and we'll help you with your mission.
Yeah. If like this. So, my response to that would be twofold. One, is there a certain way that y'all engage in evangelism? Like, when I was a Protestant, I knew, y'all may recognize you, CWT, the Roman Road, EE. Mm-hmm. I mean, we were all trained in all these various ways to engage people in evangelism. And then I get a lot of questions from the community about how do Orthodox do evangelism. So I'm kind of curious with how you engage in evangelism, you know, in the utmost parts of the earth is the same as you do in Jerusalem. But the other is, in the last few years, I had a lady just get back from Albania, Christina Kligas, and but she was one of the few that's been able to go on a short-term mission trip with OCMC, because those aren't really offered any longer, so I was kind of curious for you to discuss that maybe at all, because her coming back, you know, and I know that everybody's been before a missionary, but it's lit a fire under our parish on the local level to reevaluate our own evangelism and mission capacity. You know, what we're doing. So I'm just kind of curious if that's going to be involved in the discussion, how we may be able to be reintegrated back into OCMC's efforts on these short-term missions.
Okay, great. So I am going to touch on several of those things as we go forward, and loop back if you don't feel like we've gotten there on an answer by the end today. So hopefully we'll have time, two whole hours, so it's still an hour, 25 minutes. So we should have time to have more questions. So great questions, and I think partially I'll cover those and we can come back to them if you don't. So actually that's a great lead into, how do we think about missions as Orthodox Christians? So is there a difference in how we do missions as Orthodox Christians from how we experience missions often, you know, in other historical experiences, you know, maybe our backgrounds of people in our community that were part of other traditions that did missions. So as I thought about this, there are three basic theological principles that I think should guide the way we think. I think it's best always to start with our theological foundation and then build out on that foundation of what we're actually going to do. Because we get tripped up when we start doing stuff and then try to figure out how we justify it, you know, backwards. So the first principle, and I would hope by the end of the day you'll remember these and you can actually say them to other people. So work with. And the first principle is that we are apostolic. So this is a rich term with lots of meaning. So first of all, we know that we are apostolic because our church is founded on the apostles. That we can trace our church through apostolic succession generation after generation, and that our bishops are consecrated as direct heirs of the apostles. And all of that is true. We are authentic in the doctrine of the apostles. All of that is true about our apostolic identity. But more fundamentally, we are apostolic because we continue to be sent. The word apostle is one who is sent. The apostles were called apostles because Christ sent them. And when we say in the creed every time we do the liturgy, we believe in one holy Catholic and apostolic church, we are claiming that we believe that we are still sent. So this sending is very important. We don't have to ask if we should go, because we are sent. And unless you want to go back and edit the creed and scratch off the little apostolic word there, you know, scratch off the past that we talked about, Christ has sent us. Now, how we go is complex. Where we go is a good question. What we do when we get there, we have to figure out. But whether we are to go, it's not a question. That is not one of the things that we are supposed to be discussing. That is given. We have received the command that we are sent. Now, of course, the beautiful thing is that is everything in Orthodoxy, everything fits together, of course, and we are sent not because God thought, well, this will be a funny joke on them, send them to go do hard things that they don't want to do in uncomfortable places that are dangerous and, you know, see how they like that. But we are sent because we are followers of Christ who is sent. And he sent us as the Father has sent him. And so being sent is not an onerous duty. It is a privilege to follow Christ in knowing. And he said at the beginning, everything is about our Lord and about being conformed to his image. And it is through going that we find that true identity and participation in his life. Without willingness to know, we do not have the opportunity to participate in the life of Christ. So being sent is not a tragedy. It's a blessing. It's a privilege. But we must realize that we are sent. Now again, we are sent to be witnesses in Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and to the ends of Europe. So all of us will not go to the faraway blind spots on the map. But some of us must. And our whole communities must have the mentality of being sent. We must cultivate that. And we must question, who is sent here? Who is sent there? Where are we going? Are we being apostolic? And if we are not wrestling with that question, we are denying part of our identity as Orthodox, and we are rejecting Christ's plan for us to be formed in his image. So ultimately, we are condemning ourselves if we refuse to be sent. So, first point is we are apostolic. Second, we are incarnational. We talked about this a little this morning about thinking, reflecting on our cultural incarnation as we work here. But again, we are incarnational because our model of ministry is incarnational. Christ was incarnate for our salvation. That incarnational process is the road of salvation for us. And like Christ emptied himself So our first step of incarnation of the Word of God is through baptism, we are given a new life, and through our Christian formation, the ascetical life, the worship, the prayer, the whole process of being transformed in Christ, He is formed in us. The Word of God is incarnate in you and I. But then that incarnation goes a second step, where we must, for the sake of those who do not yet have a witness incarnate in their place and time and language and culture, we must, to some degree,
be connected
to
here.
Okay.
I've jotted everything up.
Wow.
I'm opposed to death.
Okay. I can compete with that. So. As Christ was incarnate in one place in time for us, we must be willing to empty ourselves in order to be incarnate for others. This is not an easy process. It means that strangely enough, we become strangers and aliens in this world. We only have one homeland that is in heaven. Of course, that's our calling as Christians. And again, the incarnational process is given to us as our road of salvation, being intentional of Christ being incarnate in me, and then for those who are of us who are sent to do the difficult cross-cultural long-term work of incarnating Christ for the first time in a new place of new cultures and new languages. It is a challenging path. But it's not optional. It's how Christ did it. It's how we must do it. This means that missionary service to those places without existing Christian witness is a very long-term process. You cannot do incarnation ministry in 2 weeks. It takes months, years, and really decades to become incarnate in a new place. I have been in Albania for almost 28 years, and I was still trying to figure out the culture there. Now I live in the United States, and I'm trying to figure out the culture here. So living across boundaries is a challenge, but it's also a gift. And it's where we can truly find Christ in those, in the little spaces, where we're in the middle, where we are out of ourselves and finding Christ. So, we are apostolic, we are incarnational, and we are ecclesial. And this is perhaps one of the ways that we are intentionally the most different from some of the other Christian traditions. Our goal in missions is not to share truth with people, although we share truth. It is not to get them to change their minds about something, although they do change their minds. And it's not to get them to say a prayer, although they pray. It is to invite them into a community of faith, to be part of a local Eucharistic community. So our work is to plant new outposts of the kingdom where the gospel is incarnate in new ways in which people who are created in the image of God can become truly themselves for the first time as they are incorporated into the kingdom. So, in our goal, we are ecclesial. But we are also ecclesial in our method. And this is one of the things that I would really emphasize to you. nations is the work of the church. It is not the work of an institution called the Orthodox Christian Mission Center. The Orthodox Christian Mission Center, in the wisdom of the Assembly of Bishops, exists to mobilize and facilitate the work of parishes in the task that God has given you. Now, the text earlier did say, and the Orthodox Christian Mission Center will go and disciple all nations. It is a command given to the church. And so it's extremely important that each one of our local Eucharistic communities is seriously reflecting on and asking that question. How are we being obedient to Christ's command to make disciples of all nations? How are we doing it being witnesses in Jerusalem, in Judea, in Samaria, but especially out of sight, out of mind, the ends of the earth? Those people will not come across your consciousness if you choose to be obedient. But so every one of our parishes, in our Christian formation, in our budgets, in our preaching, must be asking ourselves that question. How do we steward what God has given us to be obedient, especially for those who have never had a choice? So, these are the three principles. Again, take them home with you. We are apostolic. We are incarnational. We are ecclesial. We could spend an hour on each one of those. We won't because we have more things to do. But, think of organizing a retreat in your parishes where you have a whole day where you go through these things. You talk about how are we unique as Orthodox Christians in our work of missions. We follow these principles. Not that some others don't, but especially in our ecclesial nature, it's one of the areas that we are doing. So, and we've already mentioned the Orthodox Christian Mission Center on the top of the slides, but the core purpose of the Orthodox Christian Mission Center now is articulated as just put on the slide. So, to fulfill the Great Commission by mobilizing and facilitating U.S. parishes to partner with bishops worldwide to plant and nourish vibrant local Eucharistic communities. So every part of this is really important. So as you see, it starts with our parishes in the United States. Now it's written to be a very concise statement and fit in a box like that. So there are lots of things that are assumed that you know, such as that the Orthodox Christian Mission Center works under the blessing and direction of the Assembly of Bishops. So we mentioned bishops worldwide, but we are all called under our bishops here. Everything we do is under the guidance, direction, and blessing of our bishops. So, but as parishes under the guidance, blessing, and direction of the bishop, each parish needs to consider, how are we fulfilling the Great Commission? So we mentioned it with that, but each baptism you do the normal baptismal service, the gospel that is read, the first gospel that is read to every newly baptized Orthodox Christian, the first command that they receive from their Lord is, all authority in heaven and earth, given to me. So it is so integrated in the life of our church. But the vast majority of our parishes across the United States are not meaningfully mobilized, active in making disciples of all nations beyond the borders of the United States. So I would challenge you to go home. Ask that question with your parish. How will we mobilize? Part of what we're going to next talk about how to do that. But it is Christian Mission Center, under the direction of the Assembly of Bishops, is here to help you with your job. Jesus, in the end, is going to ask you what you did with his command. We are here to help you. We are here to come alongside. For the most part, the local parishes, individual parishes in the United States, are not equipped, do not have the logistical ability, etc., to deploy missionaries around the world. Yes, we do. The Mission Center does, and we'll come alongside you and do that together with you. So, and then in what we do around the world, there is a temptation to think that as long as we do something religious far away, it's missions. It's not necessary. We have to think strategically and realizing that, you know, there are people that do not yet have a witness. So, missions is when we cross barriers of geography, language, or culture in order to make a witness available to people who do not yet have that witness. And so we need to be very intentional about that process. We also need to be intentional that what we are going to do is plant and foster vibrant church communities. We're not just going to do evangelism. We're not just going to do philanthropy. We will do both of those things. But the ultimate purpose is a vibrant church community. If we plant a vibrant church community, then it will be self-sustaining, self-propagating. It will live beyond us. If we just simply do certain activities without planting a vibrant parish, then that will not happen. So our goal has to be working with bishops around the world, plant and foster vibrant parishes. And we can do this. There are so many opportunities. One opportunity that I'll highlight, because it will probably come up in questions in people's minds, is some of the places, actually a lot of the places that we currently work are not those right places on that. And there's two particular reasons for that. One is, those white places on the map are hard to get to. The governments are not very friendly. It's dangerous. The incarnational process is challenging. I have friends that work in many of those in evangelical commission work. Many of them, in order to work with the target group that they want to work with, have to first go to the country where they will be living and learn the national language so that they can function there. And then after 2 years or so doing that, then they make contact with the target group and begin to learn that language. And so you're 4 years in before you start. We, as Orthodox Christians in North America, have not yet invested the resources to equip ourselves to be able to go to those places. They're still waiting for us. Other Christians are going to those places. We can go. We do not have less of the gospel. We are not poor. We are not. It is only our choice to invest resources. So I invite you to think strategically and to begin to be stewards to invest our resources so that we have capacity to go to hard places. The other reality is that in many of the places where we are now working, we are working with churches that exist for reasons having nothing to do with Orthodox missionary activity. There are communities of Christians in Africa and Central America and Asia who were pre-existing Christian communities that were searching for their Christian identity and discovered Orthodoxy and came to us and said, please help us be Orthodox. Like some of the communities here in the United States, and so that's happening, the community that I've been Orthodox with, all since Chicago, we would like that. But the large communities, groups of churches, coming to us and saying, please help us be Orthodox. We discover Orthodox, and we want to be Orthodox. And if we're honest, and I don't want to talk about particularities as but as Orthodox Christians, we have done very, very little to respond to those who have come and asked our help to be formed as Orthodox Christians. We can do so much better. We invite you to partner with us to help those who have found Orthodoxy, who want to be Orthodox, who are seeking the fullness of the faith that we have the blessing of having handed to us. Let us not neglect them. So we have huge opportunities in the places where the gospel has never been heard. We have opportunities in places where the gospel has been heard, but groups of Christians are coming to us and asking, help us be Orthodox. So, Christ gave your parish this job. We're delighted to work alongside you and facilitate that process. So, moving on to sort of vision of the Orthodox Christian Mission Center, from business language and things like that, some of you may be familiar with the term BHAG. Kind of weird, but it's an acronym for a big, hairy, audacious goal. And it's really good for organizational life to have one of these. Something that we can all come together and work towards. So as I told you earlier, the vast majority of parishes in the United States are not meaningfully mobilized for making disciples of all nations. So in OCMC, we say about 25% of parishes. That means 75% currently are not active in making disciples of all nations. So this year, we have set ourselves a big, hairy, audacious goal to work with the churches across the United States to see 75% of the churches meaningfully mobilized. So, if your church is one of the ones that's mobilized, take it to the next level and mobilize the church next to you. If you're not mobilized yet, we would love to come alongside you and help you in that process, facilitate that process with you. And then the beautiful thing here is that we think we should do this because there are poor souls out there who are lost and haven't heard the gospel. And that's true. We think we should do it because Christ commanded us to do it. And that's true. But we should also do it because you want a vibrant local parish community. There's nothing like missionary vision and really understanding the gospel and taking it to those who have never yet heard it to bring vibrancy to your community at home. So, everything, the inside fits the outside. Christ commands us to do things because they're the things that will bring us life. He never commands us to do anything that would be destructive to us. It may be hard, it may be painful, and it may actually get us killed. But it will be the doorway to eternal life. It is worth it. So, if you want to mobilize your community, 3 steps of mobilization. So, what are our theological? We are apostolic. We are incarnational, and we are ecclesial. Great. So, and based on those, we have a core purpose and a BHAG, and now we're going to have 3 things that you can do to help your community be mobilized for mission. And this is a continuum. There is not mobilized and mobilized. There is beginning to mobilize, more mobilized, and super mobilized, but it's, there is so much we can do. It's bad to compare yourselves with others, but if you want to get a feeling for what mobilization might look like, you can also walk through the foyer of one of the neighboring evangelical or Pentecostal churches in your neighborhood. There's there's probably a really big bulletin board with all missionaries that support in that entryway. And that might inspire you a little bit. We're serving you. Your choice, but so, first thing, a word we already talked about a little bit, but formation. We are not actively involved in missions, first because we have a weak formation across the board in our churches, but in particular, we do not form people with an apostolic vision. This needs to start at 3 years old and go all the way through. We need to have an intentional process of formation. Every person in your parish should know that we are apostolic, we are incarnational, we are ecclesial in our mission. We need to start telling the stories of our missionary saints to our children, not as weird people that lived a long time ago, but as examples to emulate. All the people in our communities need to know that there are literally billions of people dying, never hearing the gospel, never making a choice, because we have chosen not to tell them. So we need a process of formation. We hope by next summer, watch for it sometime in January or February, we'll start advertising it, but to roll out a vacation church school program that you can run in your communities to begin telling our children that we have missionary saints and that we are called to be apostolic. You know, we have a whole calendar that if you think very hard about it, is constructed for us to know that we are an apostolic church. So, now think about this with me for just a second. You know, we start sometime in, you know, early in the year, January, February, something, with this thing called Lent. And we have this whole process of repentance and returning to the Father's house and grounding ourselves in what is the gospel and stripping away everything that is not authentic to our human identity. And then we get to Holy Week, and then we walk with Jesus to the cross. And we see him crucified, and then we celebrate with immense joy his resurrection. You know the very first gospel that's read for the resurrection? The gospel of Matthew, that we already talked about on Saturday morning. The very first thing the resurrection is about is, yes, Christ is risen, and go and make disciples of all nations. And then the epistle in the evening for the resurrectional service is Acts, the beginning of the book of Acts, when he says, you will be my witnesses. And over again throughout the apostle period, we're reminded that Christ is risen and has sent us. And so we go through all of that, celebrating Christ with us and the encounters with people that are being transformed by Christ. And then we come, of course, to the ascension, where we return to go and make disciples of all nations. You know, and the associated text with, you know, and I will send the Holy Spirit that will give you the power to be my witnesses. And so we have this 10 days of waiting. And then we have Pentecost, where the Spirit is sent for a particular purpose of going and making disciples of all nations. And then we have a week of celebrating that we have been given the Spirit to go and make disciples of all nations. And then we start the fast of the apostles, in case we weren't clear about that. So then we start a whole period of focusing on being sent out of solid work. Then we celebrate the two great apostles, the Peter and Paul, and then the feast of the apostles, and then every Sunday after that, until we start the cycle over again, it's the Sunday after Pentecost. We are sent to go. Now, how many of your people know that? How many of you know that? I mean, sorry. But, you know, the whole church here is structured so that we know that we're an apostolic church. We've got to have a process of formation. This formation will also involve bringing the missionaries that we have in. Now, the most profound, life-changing thing for a young person in terms of realizing their apostolic calling is being a missionary when they're young. Have missionaries come to the community. And not just for a quick drive-by fundraiser on Sunday morning for 15 minutes, but bring them to spend the week with your community. Meet your kids, meet your young people, meet your old people. You know, young people who hope to be missionaries someday and they can pray. Old people can really, really pray. We need them desperately and they go to missionaries too. But so this whole formation, you know, have a parish council meeting to ask the question, how are we forming people in their apostolic identity? Do they know their sin? Here's a challenging question for you. What percentage of our high school graduates has spent an hour praying and trying to discern whether God is calling them to be a long-term congregational missionary? So I've been wowing them because I've asked this question lots of places and I've gotten the answer. The answer every single place I've asked it. The answer is zero. So to put this in a little bit more challenging way, more of our high school seniors have thought about spending their life on Mars. They have thought about investing their life as a long-term incarnation missionary. And really, if you think of it, because they hear about Mars all the time. They're evangelized about Mars. They don't, but interestingly enough, there's no verse in the Bible about going to Mars. But there is one about making disciples of all nations. So, this whole process of formation, and that's just like a few ideas, but how do we make missional formation part of the life of our churches? And OCNC is here to help you in that process. We will be, over the next year or so, producing more curriculum, the Vacation Church School program, and we will begin to have, over the next year, year and a half, we will begin to have regional mobilizers in our areas of Orthodox concentration. Somebody can call up and say, could you help me? Could you come over and they'll lead the training? Can you do this? Can you do that? We'll have people available to help you in the process of the formation of your community. And of course, everything is connected. So your next thing is partnership. As you begin to form people to understand apostolic identity, they will begin to think of partnership. And this is a very important thing that we want to understand as we begin to send people out. Our missionaries are sent by the church. And being sent by the church means being sent by specific local parish communities. And for each of your parishes to really be mobilized, I would ask you to consider partnering with one of our long-term incarnational missionaries that already serving overseas. Choose one of them. Reach out to us. We can help pair you up with somebody that we need your support. But then consider that person as part of your community. You'll start by putting them in the directory, putting them on the website. Introducing them to the community. As I said before, having them come and spend a week or 2 weeks with you, getting to know everybody, so that your community has a sense that we are sending this person. We are being obedient to Christ's command to make disciples of all nations by sending somebody who is specific name, by sending Anna Valentine, by sending the McDonald's, by sending. One, I'm not going to mention all our missionaries, I'm not discriminating by mentioning some of those were just the ones that were serving with us in Albania. But go on our website, reach out to us at the Mission Center, ask for a missionary to help from there. We have very few missionaries at this point. Actually, it's almost embarrassing to think how few. The entire Orthodox Church of all of the United States has fewer missionaries than you have to know. So, 15 people personally out right now. Again, if you go down, if you're in a city of any size at all, you can find an individual congregation in an evangelical Pentecostal community that sends more people than we do as the entire Orthodox Church of North America, or of the United States. North America, if you actually know So, think about partnership. This is something you can do. It's only your choice. Yes or no. So what does partnership look like? Well, there's no spectrum. I said some of the things. Of course, one of the big things is financial. How much takes money to send people. And our missionaries are dependent on the church communities that send them for the finances that make it possible for them to go. So, think about it this way. Would it be too sacrificial, stretching you too much, to ask that you put in your budget the equivalent of one cup of coffee per family per month? Is that going to, is anybody telling me no, that would bring it back? So, you know, Starbucks cup of coffee is about $5 each now, a little more if you get fancy stuff. We can do that, right? You could do that in your parish. But as we begin to do things like that, we begin to build that partnership. And it begins to transform the way we think in our parishes. Again, money is everything, but things are really hard without some of it. And a really wise person once said, where your treasure is, your heart is, and it goes together. And so, when we begin to invest our finances, our heart goes there. In places that our heart actually is on, our finances follow. So, think about partnering with our missionaries. Think about the ways that you can begin to be centered. And finally, think about the point. We said, 15, all your fingers have your toes. So we were sending. Doesn't need to be that way. We're almost 2,000 parishes in North America, the United States. 2,000 parishes, only send 15 people. Who in your parish might God be calling to be a long-term international missionary? When the pews get full, the person on the end has to go to the mission field. So. That probably isn't the method, but who's my calling? Is it really possible that he's really not calling anybody in your community, that you just decide you're not good enough? No. Who is my calling? How do we help our people from 3 years old to begin to ask that question? Is God calling me to be one of those people? Of course, actually, it's the wrong question because we're all sent. It's just who's God sending to stay here? You know, ask the question that way. How many of you know that God has sent you to this place where we are? And, you know, describe in your own words in 3 paragraphs of ministries that God has sent you to here. Because we're all practicing stewardship, right? And anybody that can't do that is clearly called somewhere else. Because they haven't found what God has called them to do here. And we know we're all sent. So maybe try to exercise that way. So begin to think about deploying people. this will be such a blessing. You bless your community as you employ people. You bless the other communities. You will form a team of people sending somebody so that people who currently don't have a choice might have the choice to be a follower of Christ. Now, there's lots more things that, you know, we can make this a lot more complicated, but to say with the spirit of three, I'm just going to give you those three. So, we need to do formation, partnership, and mobilization. Work on each of those three. So, circling back to like, how does the question of short-term needs fit into this? We did a lot of short-term teams for a lot of years. And you know, lots of people enjoyed going on short-term teams and came back and had a really good time and thought it was great. And then COVID happened. We didn't have short-term teams for a while. So the Mission Center, I wasn't in a leadership role at that point, but they had a very good idea. They said, well, let's go back and look at what we've done with the teams over these decades, right? And we would expect to see that we mobilize people through teams. So they use fancy tools like Excel, put everybody on a mini spreadsheet, and ask questions like, you know, how many people have gone, and how did their giving change, how many of them became long-term missionaries, how many, you know, all sorts of questions. How do we see that this experience has changed? But had an impact in their life where they were involved in missions in a different way. And I think we were trying to find the answer was partly at all. So we were deploying people on short-term teams around the world who then came back with the sense that I had done my mission activity. I had completed the Great Commission. I had finished the race. You know, I had won the fight and the crown was laid out for me. And so at that point, it was decided we need to take a pause in what we're doing. We are going to be moving back into short-term teams, but in a more intentional way. So the purpose of short-term teams is, you know, multifold, but it is not the tool for planning and fostering vibrant communities where they don't yet exist. You can't do that in 2 weeks, believe it or not. Otherwise, you would plant the parish if you were planting in 2 weeks, right? In the same culture, the same language. So short-term teams are a great tool for the formation of the people that know about them. Great tool, life-changing experience, real deep Orthodox transformation. And that's one of the reasons that we will continue to send short-term. But what we need to realize is if we are sending short-term teams for the transformational experience that our young people will have, well, then we should be willing to invest financially in doing that and not thinking somehow that other donors somewhere else could pay for the transformational experience for them. So we need to take responsibility for the investment for that transformational experience. So the transformational experience is great, and we should invest in it, and there will be an opportunity to do that. Short-term teams are great for young people who explore the possible calling that they might have as missionaries, but that needs to be very explicit as part of the process of knowing. Now, you are being entrusted with a talent. That talent is going to be required of you. You have to seriously explore whether God is calling you to a long-term incarnational ministry. This is not a one-off. This is the beginning of a process for a lifetime. Short-term teams can be a great way when your community does partnership for the community to really feel that partnership. It's a great way to send a short-term team, be with your missionary on the field, and help them with something for a period of time. The purpose of that is so that you can come back and be a better partner, a better sender over time. What often happens, and I experienced this personally more than once, ascending church sends short-termers to come and help us. And then they say, well, we spent all of our budget for missions on sending those short-term people, so we'll not be supporting you this year. So instead of helping the short-termers consume the resources, they could have been used for long-term incarnational missionaries. So we need to make sure that we are actually investing in a way that gives our communities be better partners. And short-term teams can actually do some really good things partnering with long-term incarnational work. If they're not there long enough to really see deep transformation, but they are there, that together with long-term people, they can actually give a boost. They can help run a camp, do an activity, do special things that really help. And so, if it's planned right, it can actually be a blessing and help the long-term work. But if we think that short-term teams is a way of fulfilling the great mission, we're using the wrong tool. So, hammers are great for driving nails. Wrenches are great for turning nuts. Now, if you try to drive nails with wrenches, it's not going to work out so well, and the other way around. So we need to use the right tools for the right things, and we're going to be trying to reach out and do that more and more with you going forward and planning those teams in a way that we do that. An exception to this is some very highly skilled, specific givings. But we have some short-term medical needs where people with very specific, high skills like medicine can go into an existing situation and be extremely helpful, in that limited capacity in a short period of time. That's especially true with medicine. It can be true with a few other things where that high skill can allow us to make a really meaningful investment in a short period of time. How are we doing on time? So we have about half an hour left. I think I can talk about all this more stuff, but let's see if there are more questions, and if there aren't, if you're good, I'll let you out early, and if not, just keep talking.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Should I just yell? Is it better? Can you hear me?
Yeah.
So I was talking to my delegate. She's from our small mission. Near our big parish, and our mission is to Appalachia and the people there. They don't have a lot of money, and one of the challenges we face, she looks at me like, she said, I feel like we're doing this. We're doing this right where we are. My question to you, this is not a hostile question, but rather one maybe helping kind of flesh this out, because we're trying to do mission work in our own backyards, in places where there's no Orthodox presence for hours around. How do we speak about what you're doing and also talk about what we're doing in a way that doesn't create maybe competition or a sense of like, wait a second, we can't pay for a freeze for a building. How do we take up this cross?
Yeah, thank you. That is very helpful to say that out loud. And the key to this is Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and the ends of the earth. So you are in your Jerusalem doing the thing they're called, perhaps in Judea and Samaria as well, with some of the, I don't know the dynamics well enough. So absolutely, we've got to be doing that. And God bless you as you do it, and do it well to the glory of God. And and as a broader church, perhaps we can even support in doing that. But the other thing is balance in proportion in the whole picture of the whole world. So, as we are doing that, also remember that there are 2 billion people who have never heard the gospel in any language, in any culture, and is not accessible to them. So, I think the widow's mite is also a really good thing to think about. And even if it is a very poor area, not that the gift will have a massive impact by the nature of its size, but even a little bit invested to say that We are part of one holy apostolic church that spans the entire earth, and we are also interested in there. So, you know, one cup of coffee. You know, a widow's mite, to be at least investing in the realization that there is a broader picture. And maybe we do some interchanges. We're actually talking about partnering with some short-term teams in Appalachia to help prepare people for long-term service overseas, things like that. So everything, and this is one thing that the Mission Center would like to be involved in all aspects of the life of the church here, in OCS, and all the different ministries, that we can come alongside and help you to incorporate that apostolic vision that will help bring light in that hard place as you think about the mission that is brought. So I don't know if that helps to answer the question, but. Other questions? Yeah.
I have a question about the curriculum that you're creating.
Yeah.
I'm working with the Greek Orthodox Church on behalf of all. Are you able to incorporate some of those, we're talking about formation, then also the cultural access for the children who maybe have disabilities so they can access the curriculum that we're going to use to help with this process?
We would love to have a collaborative approach, and that's part of what I was saying. Lots of people, and we're trying to have at least one curriculum initiative, but lots of different churches across the country are doing lots of curriculum. We don't need to write all the curriculum. We would just like to foster the idea that our apostolic identity be incorporated in. And my wife, Gabriella, who's sitting right here, is involved in our curriculum work, so if the two of you meet afterwards, and we can build a bridge there, and we want to collaborate with everyone. We do not, we do not need to be owners. We're partners, we're stewards of what God owns. And so the OCMC would like to collaborate and support anything we can for the sake of the kingdom, for our apostolic ministry around the world.
Thank you for that. Thank you for your presentation. Something that came to mind, we had a mission for a short period of time near a university. And from that we used to see a lot of foreign students that came in. Chinese, Vietnamese, Burma, different places. And they embraced the faith. Baptized to it, I think I mentioned to you, someone from Venezuela, someone from Nepal. And they have the language already. They have the faith. So instead of the 4 years back to the process, there you have someone who's just kind of in home. I don't know, maybe you've seen this phenomenon more and more where there's a possibility of taking some of our converts that are from other countries and forming them here, and then sending them back.
Absolutely, we would love to do that. We would love, as an organization, OCMC has limited size and limited capability. By God's grace, we'll be growing, but we would love to have resources to help all of this. I said this morning, people from the white spaces on the map are here. We can witness them here, and we should be intentional about that. And then, in anything that we do to facilitate them going back home and being witnesses, it's hard. Often they will face significant persecution and very, very big challenges. But just because it's dangerous doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. It was quite dangerous for the apostles in the first century. Not a lot of them killed. But that's okay. Because we work for a kingdom that transcends this life. And so being a martyr is not the worst thing that can happen to you.
missionaries go to their countries, is their mission evangelism, social work, or is the ultimate purpose to create a church there with a priest, or how do you see that? The end of the war.
Yeah, thanks. So the goal is to see vibrant and flourishing global U.S. communities. Everything has to work towards that. Now, we may do some philanthropic work along the way because we're all about our neighbor. You know, on a large scale, for a lot of the philanthropic work, we have a wonderful sister organization called IOCC that everybody confuses with OCMC most of the time. They are better equipped, you know, on a large scale to do the philanthropic ministries. I would like to see closer collaboration between IOCC and OCMC and things like that. So that is not our focus, but we may end up doing some of that. But each place is unique, and the inputs that are necessary given the existing situation in order to work towards that vibrant global Eucharistic community is what, you know, we have to discern, working with the local bishop, and see how we can work towards that. So in some places, like with the Macarthur Seminary in East Africa, we very substantially helped with lost learning the seminaries to be preparing clergy so we can have parishes. But you know, the goal is not theological education, the goal is vibrant parishes. And in everything we do, it's run through that matrix of how will this help ultimately to have vibrant parish communities, because those are the incarnations of the Word of God in that place that become self-propagating, you know, and self-sustaining. So, as I said before, so far our capacity in those hard places is very limited. You know, we hope by God's grace to see it growing. So, you know, talk about it at this point is very incredible because we really haven't had the chance to go there. The other part is even when we start going there, I can't talk about it publicly, so I couldn't really say much. So that there are real complications and real dangers. Pray for the unity. I don't want to go into this in depth, and I don't want to say any names, but you can read between the lines. Pray for the unity of the Orthodox Church around the world. We are very fractured as a church. This was one of the things that broke Archbishop Anastasios' heart in the last 5 years of his life, and truly broke his heart to tears over and over again, was the fracture of the Orthodox world and the fact that in so many places our challenges of whether there is a bishop or which of the many bishops we will work under. And so, let me just, Lord have mercy, and pray for peace and unity in the Orthodox Church, because it is just unspeakably tragic that the fights between hierarchs actually end up being one of the greatest obstacles to missionary work. So, we're very sorry, but
I would like to. I think it's obvious that Archbishop Anastasios, with his experience in East Africa, made it possible to undertake a mission work sponsored by OCMC in East Africa.
Yeah.
But that might not be the case everywhere in Africa, for example. And so that's the case where the local ruling bishop or the metropolitan there understood the whole teaching on mission. And if you, so we'll put this as a question.
Okay.
If you are going to go and sponsor a missionary, someone to undertake mission, you're going to sponsor a missionary, undertake a mission, and there may be, for example, you don't have to name any names, etc., but where the local ruling hierarchy doesn't really want a incarnational mission or local Eucharist community in his region that's somehow not necessarily according to his dictate or his understanding of what the church needs.
Yeah. So, great question. And, you know, the fundamental principle is we work under the blessing of the local bishops. If there is a local bishop that invites us and blesses us to work, we work. If he doesn't, there are more places and more work to be done than we have capacity. So, we do not need to pry our way into any place. We do not need to insert ourselves. No, we work with bishops that invite our partnership. And you know, as you invest, you know, it is you who are investing to work with bishops that invite our partnership. And this, of course, we're talking about differences between Orthodox mission work and others. Other Christian traditions, they don't have a hierarchy of those structures, just go and check a shop wherever they want. And sometimes that allows them to do things in a quicker, more nimble way than we can, but it also creates a lot of chaos and a lot of problems. So it's what it is. But pray for the unity of the church and pray for the open doors of hierarchs that really have a burden. And pray for our hierarchs around the world. We have such wonderful bishops here in this country, and you around the world, but we also have so many bishops that are sent into very difficult situations. And they're sent without a lot of preparation, a lot of support, and they really are trying to figure out how to build a church where it's hard. So pray for them. Please pray for them. It's really important. And they're men with hearts for the gospel and hearts for the church. But we're figuring out, we're inventing the airplanes, we're flying it, and it's hard a lot of the times.
Oh, let's see.
Can I piggyback on this, this topic? Can you speak to your own experience in Albania, and particularly with Archbishop Anastasios in forming a local, vibrant Eucharistic community, where you were forced to deal with all of these, all of the divisions that you are alluding to, and particularly where you're disambiguating the history of Byzantium, Ottoman Empire, militant communism, all the pressures of the modern world, and how that might speak to what we're attempting to do here in America. Does that make sense?
So, the work of the Resurrection of the Church of Albania is an ongoing project. It's easy to read some of the things and say, God, that's beautiful. I'm glad that's finished. It's not. Churches are not born and built in a year or a decade or even a few decades. So the Church in Albania is now in a very critical sort of, I would say, third phase. So the first phase under Archbishop Anastasios in the 90s, early 2000s, was like, the rebirth, like from nothing. Literally, our bishop went around the country and did liturgies under trees or in buildings that had no roofs and and opening a seminary and all the infrastructure that was necessary. You know, going from nothing to sort of a structure in the first 12, 15 years. Then the next stage was sort of consolidation under the Archbishop. You know, more structures established, you know, administrative structures, churches built, all sorts of stuff, and really becoming more visibly established as a church. And then Archbishop Anastasios fell asleep to the Lord, he's over a year ago, and the first Albanian Archbishop was elected. So Archbishop John is now carrying the mantle. He is a wonderful, brilliant, holy man on whom a very, very heavy weight is fallen. So please pray for Archbishop John. It is an immense task to carry forward. We're blessed with a beautiful synod of godly bishops in Albania, but it's a new phase. You know, the after Anastasios phase is a challenging new phase. So in those very early years in the first stage, people flooded into the church. You know, I mean, thousands of people came and they wanted to be catechized and baptized, whatever we were selling, they wanted, because the communist government said religion was bad, and the communist government is out, and so no religion is good now. And so lots of weird things happened in Albania, lots of other Christian and otherwise groups came in, and that was like, kind of a euphoric period. Then as we got into the 2000s, it got to be more of a plateau and a slog and a challenge, as someone was talking about this morning. We see the kids coming, but we also see the kids going. We also see huge demographic changes in Albania. That Albania went from one of the youngest populations in Europe to a quickly aging population with huge external immigration and massive, massive problems with absolutely pervasive corruption. And just really, it's honestly hard to describe, but a sense of heaviness of the country developing over the years, which impacted the church. A lot of the people that would have been our seminarians ended up going abroad. We had fewer people in seminary. Our clergy, were ordained 30 years ago, are all kind of white-haired and looking old now, and lots of challenges there. And now we're in this new phase of, what's the church going to look like now? And this is where we really have to, we can't depend as we did in the early years in like the floods of people coming into the church. We're in a demographically difficult period of people leaving, and how are we really going to dig in and build those vibrant communities? And honestly, it's hard. And we need missionaries in Albania more than ever. Let's just see Gabriella afterwards and give her your names to sign up and begin interviewing. We need missionaries with a whole variety of skills, but to really come alongside the bishops and the churches in Albania to really work towards building these vibrant communities. Gabriella and I were just back there for about a month this summer. I led several different clergy trainings and other trainings. And how do we do this? How do we really move this forward? So it's a challenging process, but by God's grace, the church continues to move forward. So I think we're getting near the end here. I want to leave you with one story. So my mom passed away about 10 days ago. Her funeral was on Saturday. So I just want to tell you one story for my mom that I think brings together a little bit of the kinds of things that we're thinking about, talking about, reading about. So I grew up in Colombia, South America. My parents were Bible translators for an indigenous group that lived 30 miles walk in the mountains from the end of the road. So they literally walking 4 to 30 miles for riding a mule after the road. So that means I grew up without electricity, without running water. wonderful childhood. I did not know that I grew up deprived. I was not informed of that until much later. But my family went to that place because if somebody did not go there, cross that geography, learn their language and live their culture, they would never have been awesome. And there's multiple different stories that you want to tell you all about. But I want to tell you a little bit about the first time that we as a family made the trip up into the Central Mountains. Now, they were very secluded people, and you could not go into the, you still could not go into the Central Mountains without communication from one of the local people. They're protected by the government in this, all reservation. But through my father taught himself medical work because it was the best for me. People had no doctors at all, and he thought he could do better than nothing. He taught himself dentistry for the same reason. So the way that the Wiwa people did dentistry before he came, they got an iron nail, which was a rare thing on the outside. They had they had teeth that got terrible cavities and per peril. So we get an iron nail, heat it red hot in the fire, and drive it into the cavity to kill the nerves so it would stop perfectly. That's it. He had to do better than that. So we taught ourselves dentistry over the years that we were in the States, or in the mountains. I grew up holding the flashlight on my dad pulled teeth, and he pulled thousands of teeth over the years. So through this medical work, we were invited to go into the Central Mountains. At that time, I was 2 years old, so I don't remember this, but my mom told me this story a number of times. My brother was 4, and my sister was 9 to 15 hours. It was supposed to be one long day trip, 30 miles up into the mountains. But on the first morning, some of the animals had escaped from the crowd, there was supposed to be pack mules, etc. And we didn't get started until late mid-morning instead of early before light. So we got partway up the mountain, and where we went, we had to spend the night at a couple houses on the mountainside. Partway up. The next morning, we were getting up and loading up the animals, getting ready to go, and one of the young men that was supposed to be watching some of the mules had struck up a conversation with one of the girls in the house where we were staying. So he wasn't quite on his game getting out with the first mule going up the trail. And so when that first mule went up the trail, as he went around the corner, the very narrow trails, and they had packs on, packs on the side. So he went around the corner, and there was rocks sort of sticking out over the trail. He just packed on the trail and fell off the trail. And rolled 600 feet down the hill, fell over a cliff, and landed in a tree. And so, nobody knew the mule fall over the hill. So my dad and one of the mule drivers went to go around the circuitous way to go down into the ravine and try to find out if this animal was alive or what happened. And so my mom was sitting beside this trail with her 3 children, 4, 2, and 6 months. And she sort of wondered, what am I doing here? Who thought this was a good idea? And as she's wondering those questions, this Colombian was sort of doing some black art work in the Indian areas. I'm really supposed to do it, but to get away with it. He came up the trail, riding through donkeys, loaded with sailbags. He was going to go up into the Indian reserve and sell and come back. And he sees something that nobody had ever seen in the history of the world in that place before. A European woman sitting beside the trail with her 3 young children. He was somewhat shocked. And he sort of looks at her and looks at his mouth. He says, "What are you doing here?" And his mom tells us, she said, "I was sort of wondering the same question. What am I doing here?" But naturally, being conversational and friendly as she was, she said, "Well, I'm sitting here with my three children waiting for my husband who was long down to find a mule that fell off a hill. And for him to come back up." And this man says, "You shouldn't be here. This is dangerous." And I'm sort of thinking, you might have a pain. I'm not sure what this is all about. So they chat a little bit, and he goes on up the trail. And mom is sitting there thinking, "What in the world am I doing here? And who thought it was a good idea for me to be here on the side of the hill with my three children, mom, my husband, this mule out of the ravine?" But then she started to think, he's here. He's not one of the wheel of people. He's going up now, 20 year old. The answer was sort of obvious. So he has those two donkeys with stockings in his cell, and he's going to get $20. He's here with $20. I'm here because if I don't, these people will never have a choice. They will never have a chance to respond to the news of salvation in Jesus. I am here because I'm an ambassador who came to give with the best news that had ever happened in the world. I am here because if I don't go, no one else will, and they will never do. The guy who's willing to put $20, the person who's investing their life for the greatest cause that ever was, for the sake of the King of Kings. Now, of course, it is dangerous. Now, everybody asks me at the end of the story, what happened to the mule? So, the mule actually came out all right. He fell in a tree, and then went out and cut the tree down, and he came down, and they got it out, and he was able to walk away from it. So, but we continued up the trail. We were struck by a torrential rain later that day, and so we ended up staying in a little hut on the side of the mountain where they had a sheep and was full of fleas and a variety of other things. But eventually, we did go up into the middle of the Sinai Mountains. I grew up in the Maya hut. My dad had told you. My parents learned a language that no outside person had ever learned before. They created an alphabet for language that they had never learned before. They worked for years, despite the civil war in Colombia, despite the drug trade, despite all sorts of dangers that the communist guerrillas operated in the mountains where we were. One day, one of the bands came through and stopped at our house. And my dad was wondering what the mule, the United States Equalia, and wondering what they're for. So the leader comes in and brings some coffee, he wants to eat coffee. And my dad waiting for us. I heard you pull teeth. This one really hurts a lot. Did you help me? So he pulled teeth for the gorilla. So anyway, but today, the New Testament exists in a language. There are believers, somewhat secret, because they're still persecuted by the rest of the community scattered throughout the mountains. There is the possibility of choice because somebody thought the kingdom was more important. Most of what we're trying to do is not nearly that hard. We mostly have very safe and easy things to do, but even if they're dangerous, they're worth it. I And when we actually get out of the boat, on the water, and meet Jesus in those places, that's where we really encounter him. It's very hard to meet Jesus when you're safe and warm and full and comfortable. Not that any of those things aren't good, Union through everything. God is inviting each of us to get out of the boat in a specific way, all of us, and to meet him on the water. And for some of us, that means going to those dangerous, hard, faraway places. Are you one of those? Is somebody in your community one of those? Will you disciple people in your community? Is that their job to make disciples? Will you disciple people in your community to be those kind of disciples that are willing to do whatever the Master asks, regardless of the cost, because you're stewards, not owners? So I think that's about as much I have to say there. But thank you so much. Great to spend the time with you.